Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Timothy Snyder, Professor of History at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killing on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a Book of the Year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, and America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Snyder.
Very glad to be with you.
And Timothy, it seems that we are trapped between two autocrats, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. And the only way that we're going to be rescued from the trajectory we're on, which is a global trajectory where democracy's under assault and autocracy's on the rise, appears to be the Mueller inquiry, which the Republicans and the White House seem desperate to stall or stop. What's your sense of whether or not our fate hangs on the truth coming out via Robert Mueller?
No, it's a very fundamental question for all of the reasons that the premise of it suggests. First of all, I just want to emphasize a point that you make very briefly, which is that this is a global trend. For the last dozen years, according to Freedom House, authoritarianism has been on the rise and democracy has been receding. And of course, it's the youngest generation in the U.S. and also in Europe, which is least sympathetic to democracy and most sympathetic to authoritarianism. So there is a worrying trend here. And secondly, as you've also suggested, globalization has something to do with it. It's not that Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin are on different planets with no connection one to the other. In many ways, they're very similar creatures who are made possible by a kind of carelessness around the edges of our capitalism and a kind of skepticism about the law, which brings me to your question about Mueller. I mean, it seems to me that the Mueller inquiry stands for two very fundamental things at its heart. The first is factuality. Without factuality, we can't have a lot of things that we take for granted. We can't have democracy without factuality. The markets will cease to work without factuality. And we can't have the rule of law without factuality. And that's the second thing which the Mueller inquiry stands for. Are we a government of laws or are we a government of men? It's a very fundamental question. I think sometimes people don't see just how deep this goes. The Mueller inquiry is not about one man against another man. The Mueller inquiry is about whether law actually includes all American citizens, applies to all American citizens, or whether someone who fancies himself to be a strong man can escape law. That's what it's all about. And if it turns out that Mr. Trump can escape law, then the system itself will change pretty fundamentally and pretty quickly, which is why I think American citizens who care about the future of the republic, despite other disagreements they might have, should see the Mueller inquiry as something which we need to keep the structures that we have going.
Well, of course, the difference in a way between Russia under Putin and the U.S. under Trump is that Trump certainly appears to be acting like a guilty person. He's never tried to get out from under the accusations and the questions about the legitimacy of his presidency, which a normal person would do immediately. You know, the day after the election, he would want to clear the air, but he never has. So he's been acting like a guilty person, and he's been assaulting the people who are looking into him, both Mueller, the DOJ, and the FBI. So I suppose the fundamental difference here is that Putin, a member of the Russian or the Soviet secret police, has created a kleptocracy regulated by the Siloviki, his cronies from the intelligence world, many of whom have been turned into oligarchs. So they have basically unleashed the secret police on Russian freedom, whereas our secret police, if you will, the FBI, are the ones that we're sort of counting on to save us.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental difference that I think you're suggesting has to do with precisely the rule of law. In Russia, no one really pretends that there is the rule of law. Everyone understands that the agents of the state, the Siloviki, as you say, are acting on behalf of the oligarchical clan that happens to have won, which is the Putin clan. We're not there yet, of course, although there are some tendencies that are pulling us in that direction. And what Mr. Trump is performing is a kind of preparation for us to become more like Russia. He's trying to get everyone to believe that the rule of law is a joke. He's trying to get everyone to believe that the agencies that that enforce the law are just partial, right? That they're partial against him when really they should be partial for him. But what's consistent in Mr. Trump's remarks is the notion that any agency is not about some objective principle. It's always partial one way or the other. And if people buy that notion, then we end up not believing in law because we don't believe that law can be enforced. So that's kind of the long game that he's playing. Another difference between Russia and America, and it's one which is kind of humiliating for us, is that the Russians have a notion of what they're doing. Mr. Trump is just an instrument from their point of view. And that's very hard for Americans to grasp because, you know, we to either ignore the rest of the world or we assume that the rest of the world is somehow following our lead. That's just not the case here. And what we have in the relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump is that Mr. Putin has a notion of what he's trying to do. He's applying methods which actually have to do with the history of the Russian secret police. That's called active measures. He's using new technologies to apply old tools of secret police work to us. That was the 2016 election. In all of that, Mr. Trump is not colluding because Mr. Trump is not an equal partner. Mr. Trump is basically an instrument. He's a bit of driftwood which is floating along on the stream, and the driftwood is vaguely aware that there are larger forces around it, but the driftwood is not actually what's causing anything to happen. And so at the end of the day, we have Trump who's kind of aspiring to be in a Russian situation. He's pushing us towards being in a Russian situation. He's himself a product of Russian policy, but he's by no means an equal. And that's the odd thing. That's the odd thing for us. And of course, one sees that if you see the way Mr. Putin discusses Mr. Trump, it's much less respectful than the way Mr. Trump discusses Mr. Putin.
Well, indeed, Putin described Trump using the word "yalki," which was mistranslated as meaning brilliant, but in fact, it means somebody who likes the limelight, who likes the bright lights, etc. So, but again, I'm speaking with Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killings on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. So, we've had, of course, the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century, and many argue that we're in a second Gilded Age now. So the trend in our historical cycles has been, of late, plutocracy replacing democracy. So the fact that this current situation with Trump has Russian fingerprints all over it, a member of the minority side of the House Intelligence Committee just mentioned that, you know, every inquiry that's going on now, you shake a tree and a Russian falls out of it. How do you sort of factor that into the trend of plutocracy replacing democracy and how much Putin has accelerated this trend? Because my question would be, why are the American plutocrats not recognizing how this interloper has basically infiltrated our country, if you will? Are they happy with the idea of America becoming an autocracy too?
Yeah. So first of all, starting where you start with patterns, I think there's a background pattern here, which is how globalization goes wrong. The first globalization in the late 19th and early 20th centuries also generated ideas that sound familiar to us, like that there are no alternatives to liberalism, or that history's come to an end and we can look forward to, you know, a peaceful, predictable horizon of nothing really ever changing. And that broke with the First World War and with the Great Depression and with Stalinism and with Hitler and with the Holocaust and the Second World War. We've had a similar experience. We declared 100 years after that, we declared history was over, there are no alternatives. And then now it emerges that there are alternatives and that we've been blind to them because we've been telling ourselves that there weren't any such thing. So our, you know, in a way, the funny thing is that there's a history of globalization which we decided that we would completely ignore because we decided that everything was new. And part of that, as you suggest quite rightly, is wealth accumulation. I mean, by no coincidence, wealth inequality in the U.S. is now pretty much exactly where it was in 1929. And you have the associated political consequences, like that it's hard for people to believe in social advancement, like that people are anxious because the present seems bad to them and doesn't seem to be able to change, and also that communication is very difficult. I mean, if somebody has $1 billion and somebody else has $100, those two people might be formally citizens of the same country, but it's very hard for them to communicate. If you've got $1 billion, the truth is not enough for you, and if you've got $100, the truth is too much. And that helps us to explain how Russia interfered in the U.S. in 2016, or how it continues to interfere. We're in a situation which is vulnerable in its own right, where people have justified doubts about the formal and the substantial integrity of American democracy. And what Russia does is that it plays on that. It uses the internet to exacerbate people's doubts, to push people towards a situation not of justified skepticism, but of total cynicism, to push people away from trying to make things better and towards an attitude of, well, nothing can really change because who knows really, and it's all a conspiracy. That's the way that Russia has worked and continues to work inside our system. And, you know, as to the American reaction to this, I mean, I think a lot of wealthy Americans were surprised by this combination of real Russian oligarchy plus a fake American oligarch, because of course Trump, as far as we know, doesn't actually have any money. He's part of a global oligarchical scheme, which, in an interesting way, locks out or pushes to the side anyway some American oligarchs. But fundamentally, I don't think the situation is too surprising, because one of the ways that, you know, globalization works is that billionaires around the world have much more in common with one another than they have with their fellow citizens. So very cynical Russian oligarchs have more in common with very cynical American oligarchs than either of them has in common with the Russian or the American people. So that the fact that this can kind of be sorted out, where, you know, the Russian oligarchs get to have their candidate be president, and you know, the American oligarchs get to disassemble the Environmental Protection Agency, that this is kind of sorting itself out along those lines is maybe not really so surprising. And that's kind of where we are. The weird thing about it, the surreal thing about it, is the way Mr. Trump serves as a kind of point of contact. You know, this fake American oligarch who's a total failure in the U.S. context, but gets promoted as an American oligarch by Russian oligarchs. That's the weird thing. That's the uncanny thing, which makes it all possible.
But fairly recently, Oxfam came out with a report that something like 85 families control most of the world's wealth, or at least over half of the world's wealth. And the only historical model I can think in those terms is that we are, in fact, the planet is going back to a kind of medieval model where you have a small aristocracy with all of the wealth, and then you have a vast roiling underclass. And then in the middle, you've got a sort of sliver of lawyers and accountants who are the wealth management class. If that is the trend, what is driving it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. What I would ask would be, what can be done about it? If one looks back to, you know, the medieval or the early modern situation that you're describing, what was done about it was the creation of the state. You know, the thing that we now take for granted, that entity which claims a monopoly on legitimate violence, which has a standing army, and which is able to tax its whole population. It seems to me that there is a pretty profound lesson for us there. So much of political dialogue in the United States, or what passes for political dialogue in the United States, is simply hostility to the state. But if the state is not functional, then this kind of wealth inequality is inevitable. And, you know, what's worrisome about the coalition which is in charge in the United States right now is it's between people who want the state to be weak so they can offshore all their money, and people who have been convinced that the state can't do anything because it's not doing enough for them right now. And there's no way to fix that except to create a state which, A, does more for people in general, and B, is able to extend its authority so that it's not so easy to keep transactions and just huge amounts of wealth beyond its borders. The state simply has to be functional. If we give up on the state, if we drink the Kool-Aid of how government can't really do anything, I think it's clear that these tendencies are going to accelerate with predictable political consequences. I mean, the more that people think that the state can't do anything for them, the more frustrated and angry they're going to get, and there's not going to be any way for those emotions to be channeled into action without the state. Meanwhile, the people who actually have the resources are going to be more and more scornful of the state and more open about their scorn for the state, and the kinds of alliances like the one that brought Mr. Trump to power will become more and more common. And so people will become more nationalist, and meanwhile, the state will be ever less able to do things for people. It's not a pretty picture. So, I mean, I have a very boring, straightforward thing to say about this, which is that we need to have some kind of broader consensus in the middle of the political spectrum about the state and about the rule of law. And the people who win elections in the United States have to be thinking not just about winning elections, but about how to extend the authority of the state into certain financial spheres where it's not currently present. You know, we need to have a situation where banks can't do business with anonymous clients. We need to have a situation where less wealth is offshored. We need to have a situation where you can't register companies anonymously, because those are the things which not only directly increase wealth inequality, because they create two classes of citizens, you know, the ones who have to pay taxes and the ones that don't. They also make possible the kinds of political deals which lead to outcomes like the election of Mr. Trump. The whole spectacle of Trump takes place in that half-legal, very murky world of offshore capitalism.
Well, indeed. That, of course, explains the assault on Obamacare. They have to kill off Obamacare so that the American people don't recognize that government services actually work. I mean, social democracy works on the simple premise that you pay your taxes and in exchange they become good stewards of your money and provide you with government services. And I guess the only lasting achievement of our social democracy that arguably existed from 1944 to about 1977 is Social Security, which is also under assault. So is that what's driving the Paul Ryans of this world? They have to prove to the American people that these things don't work, or have to sabotage them to the point where they don't work?
Yes. I mean, I'm afraid that's true. That's the fundamental conversation in American politics. Can the government do something for you or can't it? And the way that Republicans win is by persuading enough people who really need government that they don't need government. That's the way it works. And you use race to make that argument. You know, you tell white people, well, of course people like us don't need the government. It's only those other people who need the government. You play to pride. And you play to a sense of individual hardiness, and you play to virtues. You play to people's sense that they really should be able to do it on their own, and that's how you twist race and class together to undo the welfare state. And then when you undo the welfare state, you get consequences like life expectancy going down in the United States, which it has for the last 2 years, and almost certainly will for this year. I'd be surprised if it picks up, if it improves any time in the near future, given that the opioid crisis is still getting worse and given that suicides are still incredibly common, especially among American military veterans. So there is something deep going on here, but I'm afraid it actually goes a step deeper and darker, which is that it's not just that you're trying to prove that the state doesn't work. It's that you take the resulting anxiety, you take the resulting fear, and you turn it against other Americans or against other groups. I mean, people refer to Mr. Trump as a populist. I don't think that's true, because a populist actually does have some vague sense that he's going to use the government to help some people. Mr. Trump does half of populism. He does the rhetorical part. But he, in policy terms, he does the opposite. He makes people's lives much, much harder by doing away with parts of Obamacare, doing away with consumer protections, by not doing anything about opioids. And I think that's deliberate. I mean, I think the point is to change the conversation about government from one where the question is, what can government do for all of us, to a question to rather government becoming a kind of public relations mechanism where, of course, we all take for granted it's not really doing anything, but it tells us who we're supposed to hate and fear and blame. So government helps to generate, you know, you disassemble the welfare state, you generate anxiety and fear and negative emotion, and then you direct it, right, which is what Mr. Trump is good at. He's good at blaming people for the dysfunctionality that he himself emits.
Well, today we just learned that the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, a billionaire Christian fundamentalist is in charge of education, has now rolled back reforms in terms of how students are being exploited in this country by these student loans, which are onerous. And it's destroying the economy because young people can't buy homes, refrigerators, cars, etc. They're indentured before they even get a job. It used to be, or it should be, that students are centers of investment, not centers of profit. But that is how our system has become so predatory. But just in the last minute here, I wanted to touch on something you brought up, and how the young, even though they, as I mentioned, the students are being, their horizons are being limited by this form of predatory capitalism, they are susceptible, probably in their anguish, to being manipulated. And of course, I think the most successful export from Putin to this country is what his political technologist Surkov managed to come up with, the idea of a managed democracy, and the extent to which, as a recent book suggests, nothing is true and everything is possible. Could you read this paragraph? Do you have the book, page 278?
You'll have to give me a second.
Because what really worries me is that I don't see how a country, particularly the world's lone superpower, can operate when there's no consensus on what is real and what is true. And Fox News already has about 40% of the country in a bubble of delusion, believing Trump and thinking that everything else is fake news. And every time you see Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Sanders, you realize the encroachment into the very foundation of a functioning society, which is whether or not we can believe what is real and what is not. So would you mind reading that second paragraph on page 278? Because I think it really sums up the challenge we have today.
All of the virtues depend upon truth, and truth depends upon them all. Final truth in this world is unattainable, but its pursuit leads the individual away from unfreedom. The temptation to believe what feels right assails us at all times from all directions. Authoritarianism begins when we can no longer tell the difference between the true and the appealing. At the same time, the cynic who decides that there is no truth at all is the citizen who welcomes the tyrant. Total doubt about all authority is naivete about the particular authority that reads emotions and breeds cynicism. To seek the truth means finding a way between conformity and complacency towards individuality.
Well, Timothy Snyder, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killing on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. He's the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And his latest book just out is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.